Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our speaker is Japonica Brown Saraceno, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Boston University. Professor Brown Saraceno's lecture is titled The Real People, Race, Class, Ethnicity, and the Politics of Preservation in Gentrifying Neighborhoods. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood from the African American Studies Program in the College and Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Boston University.
We are very happy to have our speaker, one of our own, Japonica Brown Saraceno, who is an assistant professor of sociology here at Boston University. And the title of her presentation is The Real People, Race, Class, Ethnicity, and the Politics of Preservation in Gentrifying Neighborhoods. Just to tell you a little about Professor Saraceno's background, she is an assistant professor of sociology at Boston University. She earned her PhD in sociology from Northwestern University in 2006 and has taught at Loyola and Cornell universities. Her research focus is ethnography, in particular, urban and community sociology, cultural sociology, and the study of race, ethnicity, and sexuality. Her book, which is entitled A Neighborhood That Never Changes, Gentrification, Social Preservation, and the Search for Authenticity, was published in 2010. It received, in fact, the Best Book Award from the Urban Affairs Association. Thank you very much, and I'll turn the mic over to our speaker.
Great, thank you. So at the end of December, it will have been 3 years since my book was published. Here's some self-promotion for you. As those of you who have written academic books know, for many or at least some of us, there's a rather long pause between the moment you submit the final manuscript and when you begin to receive feedback in the form of reviews and references. Over the last year or so, I've finally begun to have a sense of how my book is interpreted and applied. I've noticed that my private response to both criticisms and praise more or less boil down to a single chapter of my book, The Real People. Today I'm going to present this chapter and explain why I believe the patterns it uncovers are essential for an understanding of gentrification and particularly for attempts to intervene in it. To accomplish this, I have to start where the book does, with an overview of my core findings. I'll do this and then I'll move to the heart of today's talk, an exploration of how beliefs about race, ethnicity, class, place, and authenticity influence which groups are marked as worthy of preservation in the face of gentrification. Specifically, I'll demonstrate how racialized and class notions of independence, authenticity, tradition, place, and community inform predilection for certain long-timers. I'll conclude by arguing that this selection process should be regarded as a defining feature of social preservation, and explain why, if I were writing the book again today, I would make this argument a bit more central. On an afternoon in 2005, I entered a small grocery owned by an Iranian couple in Chicago's Andersonville neighborhood, one of the four communities I studied for my book. In a minute, I'll tell you about my sites, but for now, suffice it to say that Andersonville is a gentrified neighborhood on Chicago's north side. Once a Swedish enclave, in recent decades it had seen influxes in rough order of Middle Easterners, white lesbians, affluent white heterosexual families, and gay men. On this hot July day, I opened the shop door to the trembling voice of one of the owners, Mona. She explained that she and her husband would have to close their business because their rent had tripled. I asked Mona if she was okay. She said, "I have had four lives. Because of the war with Iran and Iraq, I lost everything. I had to leave. But I was okay. I was strong. I came here. But this is worse, because where are my human rights? They come, they put in flowers and condos, and then I have to go." Sadly, Mona did indeed go. After her store closed, Andersonville's fourth high-end frame shop opened in the space. While this story is undoubtedly sad, and this is only one of countless parallel events I witnessed during 4 years of fieldwork, I imagine that it does not surprise. Scholars have long documented gentrification's consequences for poor and working class residents. They have also provided a clear image of the individuals who, with city government and private investors, drive gentrification. Of, for instance, the gentrifier who realizes his or her dream of opening a frame shop without concern for that which once stood in its place. In short, the literature emphasizes gentrifiers' singular attention to progress and grave indifference for long-timers. Initially, I anticipated that I, too, would tell this story about gentrification, or at least about urban gentrification. By conducting ethnographies of two Chicago neighborhoods, Andersonville and Argyle, and two small towns, Provincetown, Massachusetts, and Dresden, Maine, I hope to compare the contours of urban and small-town gentrification. When analyzing my data, I found that the greater task was to try to understand how gentrifiers behave and how they conceive of themselves, the places they live, and their participation in gentrification. In the end, I concur with the bulk of scholars who argue that gentrification's cumulative outcomes are more often than not devastating for longtime residents like Mona. However, my book calls for a fundamental reevaluation of a key dimension of gentrification scholarship, our understanding of gentrifiers' motivations for engaging in gentrification and of their daily practices. While my research certainly uncovered gentrifiers like the ruthless pioneers the literature features, I was surprised to discover that most gentrifiers I interviewed had a more complicated orientation to gentrification. Nearly all recognize that they contribute to displacement. Many were concerned with preserving authenticity. For this reason, I have a different story to tell about how political economy and culture conspire to shape gentrifiers' choices and practices and how these alter the lives of those like Mona. I also have a story to tell about why Mona and her business were displaced from Andersonville, even as Swedish small businesses remained. To tell these stories, I must briefly review the literature on gentrification. For 4+ decades, scholars have studied gentrification, which Gina Perez defines as a process whereby private capital and individual homeowners and renters reinvest in fiscally neglected neighborhoods through housing rehabilitation, loft conversions, and construction of new housing. Gentrification is also supported by public investment of funds preceding or following the in-movement of the gentry, who are often, although not always, relatively young, white, and highly educated. Gentrifiers' motivations for moving vary, but some do so as an investment or to find affordable housing, employment, or cultural amenities. The gentry, together with public and commercial investment, breeds rising costs and transformations that are geared toward gentrifiers. These lead to physical displacement and to what Michael Chernoff terms social displacement, the replacement of one group by another in terms of prestige and power. While most studies of gentrification take the city as their subject, others document rural or small town gentrification. Demographic and economic trends, such as the baby boom generation's demand for housing in the 70s and 80s, and boosters with an interest in economic revitalization, encourage gentrification. However, many agree that demographic and economic factors cannot alone explain gentrification's breadth. Scholars like Sharon Zukin argue that culture contributes to many individuals' decision to invest in gentrifying space. Specifically, scholars identified an orientation among gentrifiers that supported their engagement in the process, what Daphne Spain terms the frontier and salvation mentality, which glamorizes personal sacrifice and sweat equity as methods for settling the city. Such scholarship suggests that gentrifiers celebrate places for what they might become rather than for what they are. As Levi and Sabruski write, the prospect of changing a neighborhood was a challenge and a social responsibility. Recent scholarship expands on this by showing how gentrifiers work to distance themselves from the gentrified. Geographer Neil Smith argues that fantasies about recolonization sustain gentrification as, quote, urban pioneers seek to scrub the city clean of its working class geography and history. From this perspective, pioneers engage in gentrification for financial gain, but also because of a belief in gentrification's virtue. Monique Taylor writes that, quote, middle-class black newcomers to Harlem explain themselves as actors returning to the ghetto and rescuing it. And in Elijah Anderson's words, the emerging neighborhood is valued largely to the extent that it is shown to be separate from low-income black communities. In short, the literature suggests that gentrifiers' relationship to long-timers almost uniformly predicates itself on distance and conflict. Where the literature does acknowledge ideological diversity among gentrifiers, it nonetheless assumes neat correspondence between an actor's structural position and ideological orientation to gentrification. According to this logic, the only gentrifiers critical of gentrification are those who are economically marginal and themselves at risk of displacement. Artists are often held up as representing this model. Given the literature's emphasis on gentrifiers' frontier and salvation ideology, I was surprised when many gentrifiers I interviewed and many others I observed departed starkly from the ideology and practices associated with the pioneer. Specifically, 37 of 80 gentrifier informants articulated an ideology quite distinct from the frontier and salvation framework. For instance, I interviewed a Provincetown homeowner, a middle-class and middle-aged white gay man, who worked to establish a cultural sanctuary to preserve, in their words, the town's fertile cultural ecology, particularly its Portuguese fishermen and artists. For him, what makes Provincetown a place he wishes to live is the presence of those who were there before him. In Chicago's Argyle, which is home to many Vietnamese and other Asian old-timers and their shops, I observed a rabbi who seeks to prevent the disruption of Argyle's Asian streetscape at the expense of his own cultural tradition, despite Argyle's history as a Jewish enclave. He said, "This is an old community built upon various cultures and ethnicities. We want to have a kosher delicatessen here, and God, we need a kosher delicatessen. But it doesn't have to be on Argyle. Let's be perfectly honest, it doesn't belong here." Meanwhile, in rural Dresden, Maine, newcomers purchased acreage from a retired farmer for whom property taxes had become unaffordable. They did not do so as an investment. In fact, they agreed not to develop the land and instead sought to maintain the presence of a farmer who, for them, lends the land meaning. 1,200 miles away, a white gay resident of Chicago's Andersonville suggested that his move to the neighborhood was equivalent to colonization and derided the increasing presence of gay men like himself. Such anecdotes have led me to conclude that, on the whole, the gentrification literature presents an oversimplified image of the gentrifier as pioneer, as well as of the relationship between economic position and ideology. Most dramatically, the literature has overlooked what I call the social preservation, ideology, and practices of some gentrifiers. Social preservation, a heretofore little examined set of beliefs and practices, is an orientation to gentrification and longtime residents markedly distinct from that of the pioneer. For social preservationists, the central city and small town are attractive because they possess old-timers, the longtime residents they most admire and who they believe have a rightful claim to their place of residence. Those who adhere to the preservation ideology, who, like other gentrifiers, tend to be highly educated and residentially mobile, move to live near old-timers. Those who articulate the preservation ideology engage in political, symbolic, and private practices to maintain place character, primarily by working to prevent displacement. Like those who seek to preserve nature, social preservationists, those who adhere to the preservation ideology and engage in related practices, work to preserve the local social ecology. They combine ideology with practice by working to prevent old-timers' displacement, despite acknowledging the disruption their own in-migration causes. Their concern for old-timers is rooted in empathy, as well as in appreciation for old-timers' communities. From preservationist perspectives, gentrifiers fall into two bodies: callous pioneers on the one hand, and on the other, those who recognize their complicity in gentrification and seek to undo the harm they cause. At first, having identified social preservation, I concurred that the field was divided between preservationists, who don't fully recognize themselves as such, and pioneers. However, I came to recognize that social preservationists and pioneer don't capture the full range of variation among gentrifiers. Indeed, few I interviewed actually fit the literature's image of the pioneer. While preservationists are most distinct from the pioneer model, many fall between the preservationist and pioneer, neither seeking to prevent displacement nor wholeheartedly supporting total transformation. Like preservationists, they deem certain place attributes such as houses or landscape authentic and work to preserve them, although they rarely directly tie authenticity to old-timers. I have come to think of these gentrifiers, who are neither speculators nor social preservationists, as social homesteaders. Some use homesteader synonymously with urban pioneer. I assign new meaning to homesteader. As I use it, homesteaders, like all other gentrifiers, engage in the transformation of poor and working class spaces to serve middle class purposes. However, their interest is less in clear-cutting wilderness than in selectively and somewhat cautiously altering it to build a home. That is, homesteaders are not pioneers who boldly and unapologetically seek to retake space. However, they are less hesitant than preservationists about making space for themselves. For instance, homesteaders advocate for changes to improve their quality of life. Some lobby for improvement to schools, while preservationists worry about the costs for old-timers of the tax increases such alterations require. Likewise, many homesteaders prioritize the preservation of the built or natural environment over long-timers. Thus, while preservationists are not alone in their resistance to gentrification, they nonetheless stand apart from other gentrifiers. Only they relocate to live beside old-timers and put the preservation ideology to practical use. Some homesteaders articulate taste for what Christopher Millay terms the cultural practices of the categorical other. But there's difference between symbolic consumption of difference or diversity and social preservation. Preservationists enact appreciation for difference through practices intended to preserve that difference. They are also highly self-reflexive, articulating cognizance of their social impact, a sophisticated understanding of political economy, and recognition that symbolic preservation can lead to displacement. Given its grand departure from the pioneer model, I take social preservation as the primary focus of my book. However, I believe that to deny attention to homesteaders would risk reifying the oversimplifications I seek to correct. Indeed, I don't want to overstate the differences between the typologies. One's ideology or practices may change over a lifetime, as is the case with several preservationists who encouraged gentrification through the restoration and sale of historic properties and later sought to reform themselves. For this reason, I use the categories to describe the ways gentrifiers oriented themselves ideologically and practically to gentrification during the period of study. In this sense, we might consider the categories ideal types. My findings are based on the comparative ethnographic study of four sites. Dresden, a picturesque town of 1600 in central Maine, located 23 miles from coastal Booth Bay Harbor, 13 miles from the Bath Ironworks factory, which is a major employer, and 18 miles from the state capital. The state government is also a major employer. Once a farming community, today few farms remain. Dresden has seen two waves of newcomers, first in the 70s of highly educated back-to-the-landers, and more recently of retirees and professionals. Dresden preservationists primarily seek to preserve farmers and others who work the land. Second site is Provincetown, maybe more familiar to most, on Cape Cod, the first landing place of the Pilgrims, which was once a whaling port and Portuguese fishing village. In the last century, it became a renowned home and destination for artists and writers, as well as gays and lesbians. The population varies from approximately 3,400 in the winter to as many as 50,000 on a busy summer day. Today, small condos list for $200,000 to $600,000 and houses for $1 to $2 million. Provincetown preservationists work to preserve Portuguese fishermen, their descendants, and struggling artists. The third site is Chicago's Andersonville neighborhood, which was a Swedish enclave for the first half of the 20th century. In the 80s and 90s, Middle Easterners and lesbians moved in, with more recent influxes of affluent professionals, both heterosexuals and increasingly gay men. Like Provincetown, Andersonville is highly gentrified. Andersonville preservationists work to preserve Swedes, despite the fact that they compose less than 4% of the population, and secondarily, some independent business owners. Finally, for much of the 20th century, Chicago's Argyle neighborhood, which is adjacent to Andersonville, was home to Jews and later working-class Appalachians. Since the 70s, many Asian immigrants have moved to Argyle, joining a neighborhood populated by African Americans and descendants of Andersonville Swedes, among others. Vietnamese, Chinese, Korean, and Laotian establishments dominate the main street. Recently, young white professionals have moved to Argyle. Argyle preservationists work to preserve Asian, particularly Vietnamese, small business owners. I selected the sites because of their demographic changes that indicated gentrification. I sought communities that were similar in this way, but that varied in terms of location, population size, stage of gentrification, and residence traits. The sites provide valuable sets of similarity and difference. Over 4 years, I observed church services, protests, block clubs, safety and town meetings, and daily public life, as well as 17 community festivals. I also conducted 160 interviews. I used a snowball sample to locate informants, but sought a sample reflective of local demographics. A little over half of informants were newcomers and the rest long-timers. The majority were publicly engaged individuals. I should specify that I follow my informant's lead in my use of old-timer as well as in authenticity. Of those gentrifiers interviewed, slightly less than half were later coded as preservationists, and most of the rest as homesteaders. I coded a person as a preservationist when she articulated resistance to gentrification and concern that gentrification will lead to old-timers' displacement, identified her neighborhood or town with old-timers, and importantly, engaged in practices to prevent old-timers' displacement. Central to social preservation is distaste for the presence of others who share one's traits. For instance, a preservationist said of Andersonville, "It's jogging strollers and Starbucks now, and it makes me sick." A white Argyle professional concurred, "I don't want to live where everybody looks like me. I already know people who look like me, a lot of people." As a result, preservationists seek places marked by evidence of the culture and community of those unlike themselves, namely those they deem old-timers. For instance, a Dresden preservationist recalled his decision to move to town, telling me, "I grew up in the suburbs and I hated every minute of it. When we drove into Dresden, we thought, this is a rural town. This is the real thing. It still makes me giddy to think about it. We thought, this is it. You can't get any more authentically New England than this. This isn't the tourist version. This is the real thing. There's nothing virtual about this. There's no suburban imitation here. This is the genuine artifact." For him, Dresden's authenticity rests on its landscape, and in his words, the presence of people who had been here before us. Such old-timers, he said, provide a sense of community and collective memory. In contrast to homesteaders who often seek to preserve buildings or landscape, social preservationists prioritize old-timers. According to a Chicago resident, historic preservation encourages rising property values and old-timers' displacement and therefore is antithetical to real preservation. He said, "The tragedy is that while saving buildings are important, people are more important. And to have a building saved where the people who lived here are all gone is to me not real preservation. Real preservation is preservation of a place, which is the building fabric, but it's the people too, and the culture, and the food, and the signage, and the music, and the interaction. That's a place, that's culture, and this was a great place, and it should have been saved." Social preservationists oppose gentrification because it displaces old-timers and regard even changes that most deem positive, such as beautification and the presence of affluent newcomers, as negative. The greatest contrast between preservationists and other gentrifiers is social preservationists' appreciation for certain long-time residents or old-timers. For instance, a Dresden newcomer said that the people who had been here before us lend a sense of community. A Provincetown preservationist spoke with sadness of the displacement of the Portuguese, adding, "When you lose the working class sector of people, you lose the soul of the community." In this, they celebrate what they regard as old-timers' privileged relationship to community and worry that gentrification, in one woman's words, erodes community and, quote, "rolls over community in an irretrievable way." As such words suggest, preservationists are highly critical of their role in gentrification. For instance, an Andersonville preservationist admitted, "We were part of the change process unwittingly." Similarly, an Argyle preservationist acknowledged, "I'm a seed for gentrification." In this way, preservationists engage in preservation work because they recognize the threat their presence poses to old-timers. The ideological and practical distinctions between preservationists and other gentrifiers inspires curiosity about whether their ideological differences are parallel to other demographic or cultural distinctions, a topic to which I devote a chapter of my book. I'm not going to go into detail about those findings today, but in short, my data suggests that for actors with distinct approaches to community change, preservationists and other gentrifiers share a remarkable number of traits. However, they also indicate that social preservationists are particularly status-secure gentrifiers. That is, social preservationists believe they have resources that they can use to resist gentrification. Indeed, they employ political, symbolic, and private strategies to limit old-timers' displacement. Political practices include affordable housing advocacy and protests against upscale development. Symbolic practices include efforts to establish Andersonville's Swedish streetscape and portraits of Portuguese women placed on a Provincetown pier to, in the artist's words, help keep the spirit and presence of the Portuguese alive. Private practices range from supporting old-timers' businesses to ending a relationship with a boyfriend because he's a pioneer, as an Argyle preservationist did, or renting one's home at a loss to provide affordable housing, as Provincetown preservationists do. Social preservationists frequently engage in discursive labor, such as by constantly policing the borders of old-timers' community. For instance, one said, "Would I ever feel like a townie? Never. It's a line you don't cross." Preservationists believe that old-timers' community is, quote, rich in friendships that extend back in time, and that old-timers have an old boy network and an old girl network, and this same network doesn't exist for newcomers. In this, they believe community belongs to mutually dependent individuals who share trait, space, and blood ties. This way of thinking about community is of consequence, not only because it drives efforts to save old-timers, but also because it reinforces preservationist sense that some residents are more authentic than others. They work to preserve particular groups, and definitions of community are essential to their selection and their explanation thereof. For instance, an Argyle preservationist advocated for a living facility for elderly Asian and Jewish residents to preserve community, making no mention of the neighborhood's African American and white ethnic populations. Indeed, he later argued against a facility for the mentally ill because, quote, the residents will not be former residents of the community. Of course, Argyle contains mentally ill residents, and the facility would draw residents from outside Argyle. Arguably, the preservationist unintentionally revealed his belief that some better typify Argyle than others. Likewise, in Andersonville, when the Iranian shop owner was displaced, a few newcomers were sorry to see the store and its owner leave and a high-end frame shop replace it. However, none suggested that their loss threatened Andersonville's character. For most, that character is Swedish, and the Iranian store fell outside the scope of their efforts. Sometimes social preservationists overlook those we might imagine they would celebrate for their special claim to local history or general social status, like descendants of Provincetown's WASP whaling captains. Instead, the cultural sanctuary Provincetown preservationists organized seeks to preserve Portuguese fishermen and struggling artists. To preserve culture was to preserve certain residents. Despite their heightened self-reflexivity about gentrification, social preservationists are chiefly unaware that they select preservable old-timers from a pool of residents. They are also largely unconscious of the fact that the old-timer is not a fixed category, and that they engage in the construction of old-timers by emphasizing certain of their traits. They celebrate a farmer or fisherman when he fishes or farms, not when he watches TV, shops at a mall, or performs other practices preservationists also engage in. Having established that preservationists engage in a selection process, the question remains of which longtime residents preservationists seek to preserve. Whom do they believe has the greatest claim to authentic community and therefore to a place? Second, what beliefs, stereotypes, and political economic factors influence association of a place with a particular group? Finally, to what degree do they work alone? How does one group become the rightful owners of place? Occasionally, preservationists hinted at the criteria used to determine old-timer status. For instance, on the first Saturday in March, Provincetown residents gather at their town hall, a white clapboard building in the town center, for the Year-Rounders Festival. In 2002, during the festival, there was a variety show, and a drag queen, Isadora with Moore and Mora, took to the stage. The audience was notably different than Isadora's summer audiences at a local bar. Children ran between chairs, grandparents held babies. Isadora, wearing a blonde wig and a flowing pink gown, prefaced her performance saying, "This is my 17th year in Provincetown." The audience met her announcement with much applause. "Some of us," Isadora said, "come across the bridge onto Cape Cod and never leave." The crowd remained quiet. "So, 17 years, Isadora spoke carefully. "Am I a townie yet?" The auditorium resounded with silence. Finally, a few residents replied meekly, "Yes," but a collective "No" countered their affirmation. "I'm not?" Isadora asked, her tone unsurprised. "Well then, how long do I have to be here to be a townie?" This time the audience agreed. A chorus of "forever" rang throughout the hall. "Well, you better get used to it," Isadora said before breaking into song, "because I'm going to be." While it's not altogether surprising that Provincetown's Portuguese Catholic lifelong residents don't consider Isadora a true townie, it may surprise that some social preservationists, many of whom are gay or lesbian, concur and would never bestow old-timer status on lifelong residents who share their traits. For instance, a young lesbian social preservationist shared observations of rules that govern who is a townie. "I meet these old lesbians that are like in their 60s. They've lived here for years and years and years and years. But there's always this thing about who's a townie, who's a native, who lives here and who doesn't. They've lived here for 20 years. They're still not a native." Amy recognizes that she abides by unspoken rules about who's a townie, who's a native, and that ethnicity, race, class, and occupation figure into her identification of residence. In fact, in her mind, these rules are so strict that they shape her ability to accurately recognize residents' traits. She told me, "I always thought this guy was this old Portuguese fisherman because he has really brown and leathery skin, and he's always lived in P-Town. But he's not. He's black. I mean, he's African-American. Somebody says he doesn't want anyone to know he's black, and I'm like, he's not black, he's Portuguese. And then the man we were discussing looked at me like I fell off the turnip truck. I'm like, wait, you're black? Everybody's like, look at him, how can you not know? And I'm like, I just thought he was brown from the sun. I just thought he was old and weathered. And they were like, what? Because it's your assumptions. You don't assume that any African-American person lives in Provincetown or is a true townie because everybody here is Portuguese. Thus, Amy realized she did not have a place for an African-American fisherman in her conception of a townie, nor could she, despite her own sexual identity, regard a longtime lesbian resident as an old-timer. And while she acknowledges that she excludes such individuals from the old-timer category, she remains unaware that the Portuguese compose only a minority of P-Town's population, roughly 23% in 2000. That is, for Amy, place identity is so linked to the Portuguese that she dramatically overestimates their presence, even misidentifying an African-American longtime resident as Portuguese. Alternately, some recognize the presence of non-old-timers, but nonetheless believe that one group has an indisputable claim to place. For instance, over dinner in a Mexican restaurant, a social worker acknowledged Argyle's diversity, but suggested that Asians are its bedrock, saying, "On the corner, you'll meet people from Croatia, from Russia, from Pakistan, but the underlying thing is the Asian community." In one way or another, in each site, preservationists select old-timers from a pool of actors and abide by local rules that influence their selection process. But what are these rules? After all, they do not always work to preserve those who comprise the majority, nor those with the longest residential history. In Andersonville, they overlook lesbians in favor of Swedes, despite the fact that they compose less than 4% of the neighborhood's population. In Argyle, they seek to preserve the Vietnamese, but neglect longtime African-American residents who constitute 22% of Argyle's population. I argue that the heart of our explanation rests in preservationist ideologies about authenticity and community, ideologies that entangle with beliefs about race, ethnicity, class, and sexuality. In each site, they select preservable old-timers from a pool of long-time residents, and given the admiration for old-timers' authentic community is at the root of their ideology, their selection process reveals beliefs about groups' claims to real community. I have identified three characteristics they associate with authentic community and those as seemingly distinct as Vietnamese shop owners and Maine farmers. First, they're attracted to what they regard as old-timers' independence, embodied by small business ownership, self-employment, and even struggling artists' unemployment. Old-timers' closed networks, i.e. newcomers' exclusion from them, is a final indicator of old-timers' independence and of the strength of their community. For instance, preservationists appreciate, quote, "struggling new citizens in America who have their own little ethnic businesses." At a Provincetown meeting, a woman said that by supporting affordable housing, she feels not so much that I'm doing something for someone else, but for myself. I want poets, writers, carpenters, people who do things with their hands, not a she-she community. Old-timers' economic struggle and their independence from newfound community wealth simultaneously suggest independence and a mutual in-group dependence that preservationists regard as indicative of strong community. For instance, a Dresden preservationist described old-timers as, quote, pretty self-sufficient. They have several jobs instead of just one. They're very real, I guess. Second, they're attracted to those with shared traditions, such as a common religion, annual cultural events, blood ties, a foreign language, and the continuation of traditional trades, traditions they associate with stable community. Specifically, preservationists value cultural continuity. Quote, they're Vietnamese or Thai. It's their culture. That's how they lived in their country. They appreciate space marked by references to another place and labor practices reminiscent of the past. Finally, they view family continuity as a fundamental reason to resist displacement. One said, there's a sense of community, especially in the Asian community. You get the sense that the guy across the street is watching the kids play on the corner. So it's not only the little kids, it's the old Vietnamese men sitting in the bakery every morning. There's a sense of family. Another said, it has to do with people's ability to remain in their communities. Some said, I was very naive to suggest that people had any right to raise kids in the community where they grew up. To me, that kind of continuity is what community is about. Finally, they appreciate old-timers' close relationship to their place of residence, demonstrated by place-based work, cultural activities, or small business ownership, activities that reinforce and reflect place identity. Preservationists believe that connection to place strengthens community. For them, old-timers' place rootedness is a vital measure of community viability. As an Argyle man said, I like the idea of somebody living where their store is, because then they're also more committed to the community. In small towns, preservationists appreciate old-timers who entangle with landscape. In Provincetown, they appreciate a harbor dotted with fishing boats and fishermen's faces weathered by the sea. Preservationist admiration for old-timers' independence, tradition, and relationship to place reveals aspects of their own identities of which they are critical. That is, they associate authentic community with and highly value traits they do not share. This is readily apparent in the contrast they draw between themselves and old-timers and their articulation of desire to live apart from those who share their traits. They criticize newcomers' transience, secondary ties, and money. Many gay preservationists express distaste for residents alongside those who share their sexual identity. A white gay Argyle man confessed he couldn't live where gay men were the majority because it would be too homogeneous, yet enjoyed what he articulated as the homogeneity of the Vietnamese community. This desire to live apart from other members of their social group uncovers an implicit self-critique. By seeking to preserve those unlike them, preservationists reveal their sense that communities composed of highly educated, mobile individuals are inauthentic. That said, we still have this question of how they decide which groups are most unlike them, which are independent, traditional, and rooted in place. Why, for instance, the Vietnamese in Argyle and not Chinese or African Americans? The answer rests largely in the fact that preservationists rely on stereotypes about social groups, as well as on narratives about local character and history, as well as about gentrifiers. This fusion of stereotypes and place narratives is particularly apparent in the prioritization of Vietnamese rather than Chinese Argyle residents, despite the fact that each group composes about 20% of the neighborhood's population. The influence of local narratives begins to indicate that preservationists aren't working alone in their selection process. They draw from local logics about the real resident, and certain events such as festivals help construct or affirm such definitions. For instance, on the evening of Isadora's performance at the Year Rounders Festival, a preservationist proudly affirmed Portuguese performer's old-timer status, introducing one as a graduate of Provincetown High and another as a native son. The audience met such performances with warm applause. Later, a graying bearded resident, a newcomer wearing a tapestry knotted under his neck and a matching cap, performed his composition, Prelude to the Butterfly. In the course of his performance, a middle-aged Portuguese man turned to the woman beside him to say, I can't believe this is our town. There's some guy up there acting like a butterfly and blowing on a flute. Can you believe that this is our town? Speaking loudly enough for others to hear, the man discursively separated this performer from our town. Thus, preservationists are not the only residents who differentiate between old-timers and others. Notably, not all long-timers call for their own preservation. For instance, at an Argyle meeting, residents sought to decide which local groups a mural should represent. Bob, a white middle-aged resident whose Swedish family had lived in Argyle for generations, argued for the inclusion of Appalachians and Asians. He said, quote, "The diversity in Argyle was amazing when Appalachians lived here and as Chinese and Vietnamese arrived." He did not call for the inclusion of his own group, associating them instead with neighboring Andersonville. However, when pressed, he expressed strong views about which longtime residents the mural should not represent. The leader of a nonprofit funding the mural said, "I want to get back to ethnicity because that's what the mural is about." Referring to the neighborhood's SROs, she asked, "When is the heaviest time when they declassified the mentally ill?" Bob responded incredulously, "That's an ethnic group?" The administrator retorted, "Ethnic or not, they've had a big impact." Later, she pressed him to consider another group for inclusion, saying, "Another group is gangs in the 60s, 70s, 80s. This seemed to offend Bob even more than including the mentally ill. We don't want them in the mural." The woman pressed ahead, "But they help the affordability." In this sense, even those longtime residents whom preservationists do not consider old-timers, such as Argyle Swedes, participate in the selection of groups for preservation and do not necessarily advocate for themselves. Local definitions of the old-timer are also reinforced by local institutions, some of which social preservationists are responsible for, such as the presence of a Swedish-American museum and the absence of a Middle Eastern museum, a mural depicting Asian immigrants and not African Americans or mentally ill SRO residents. Such institutions and symbols claim space for particular groups and influence or reinforce preservationist selection. As a man said of a pagoda, a booster placed on the Argyle L stop in 1991, "At that time, the neighborhood could have gone either way. The pagoda stamped it as Asian." Another added, "The pagoda convinced me to live here." Thus, like material preservationists, social preservationists select objects of preservation from a pool of candidates. They do not automatically work to preserve those who constitute the numerical majority, nor those with the longest local legacy. While beliefs about racial and ethnic groups' authenticity, independence, and claims to community inform their choices, traditional racial and ethnic hierarchies, or a price inversion thereof, do not always explain why they prefer the Portuguese to WASPs or Vietnamese to Chinese merchants. Instead, they seek certain old-timers with whom they associate authentic community because of their perceived independence, tradition, and close relationship to place. Underlining this is the belief that community membership is a birthright rather than a practice, a nostalgia for a gold age of community. While I've marked these patterns in old-timer selection that span sites, I've also emphasized how such choices are place-based and interact with local institutions, symbols, and landscape. That is, there is no universal old-timer. A Portuguese fisherman would not be preserved in Andersonville, nor a Vietnamese Dresdenite. Preservationists draw from local history, demographics, institutions, narratives, and landscape to identify old-timers. Those they don't preserve in my sites may elsewhere be an object of preservation. As Mary Patillo has found, African-American professionals in a gentrifying African-American neighborhood may work to preserve some working-class African-Americans. It's also possible that the object of preservation will change within a site. This is not to dismiss the import of independence, tradition, and place rootedness. Rather, the articulation and arrangement of those qualities is context-specific. How do preservationists reconcile concern for the displaced with advocacy for only some? They are largely unaware of alternate candidates for old-timer status. They rarely celebrate old-timers by actively demeaning or opposing other long-timers. Instead, they rarely mention them unless pressed to defend them from pioneers' vitriol. For instance, while Argyle preservationists focus on saving Vietnamese residents, at several public meetings they came to the defense of young African Americans whom pioneers were labeling gangbangers, such as when a pioneer indicated that he would like to see such young people perish while cutting the electricity to local streetlights. Such interventionist moments aside, like most actors, preservationists do not think of community in terms of official boundaries, seeing instead colloquial neighborhoods defined by networks of people bound by shared traits. Neighborhoods and towns thus defined, they don't see themselves neglecting those outside old-timers' networks. This is redolent of claims others have used to restrict the presence of non-white others from ethnic enclaves, and this dimension of social preservation should not be overlooked. In this sense, preservationists are not the unambiguous saviors of those threatened by gentrification we might wish them to be. Given this, I'm often asked whether social preservation works. As we have seen, preservationists work to preserve only some, and the groups they admire are generally small. In all four sites, old-timers compose a third or less of the population, and in three sites, preservationists overlook racial minorities. Thus, while social preservation upends many assumptions about gentrifiers, it shares some traits with efforts to preserve community for the benefit of some at the exclusion of others that have shaped cities and towns for centuries. In this sense, we know it doesn't work for all. Yet I argue that our inquiry ought not stop with questions of whether social preservation works. Historic preservationists have long argued that the work of saving the past is messy and revealing, that only in our most romantic fantasies do historic preservationists freeze time or save everything. They have also revealed the value of asking how and why historic preservationists focus on certain periods or aesthetics. I argue for the utility of adopting a similar approach to the question of which individuals and groups social preservationists aim to save. Out of this emerges a clear picture of the fallacy of trying to paint social preservationists, as some of my readers do, as either saviors or as pioneers in disguise, as anything other than complex actors embedded in hierarchies and markets influenced by city policies and ideas about community and authenticity. Moreover, I hope I have made clear today that gentrification is a dynamic, place-specific process. Attention to this dynamism is vital. This facilitates attention to and ability to respond to gentrification in a number of contexts. This might seem obvious, but the gentrification literature regularly defies this logic. Let me provide a couple of concrete examples. In the 80s, when gentrification scholarship began in earnest in the U.S., most characterized the process as the movement of white gentry into working-class white ethnic neighborhoods. Gentrifiers' preference for such neighborhoods, the literature suggests, was rooted in racist attitudes as well as an economic and institutional racism that differentially impacted the physical and institutional infrastructure of urban spaces. More recent literature has productively troubled this narrative in a few ways. First, by documenting the gentrification of African American, Latino, and Asian neighborhoods, and secondly, the role of African American gentrifiers. This move is quite welcome for its position to demonstrate the variability of gentrification's actors and locations and raises vital questions about gentrification's historical variability as well as about spaces and actors early scholars likely missed. Yet my enthusiasm for this trend is not unambiguous. For some, cast these empirical developments as representative, not as an additional gentrification, but as the gentrification. Over and again, I find scholars defining gentrification as the movement of white populations into African American and Latino neighborhoods. This, of course, risks making the same error early scholars made and raises old and new questions. Where does such a definition leave neighborhoods that don't fit this profile? Are upper middle class African American professionals not to be counted as gentrifiers? As Damaris Rose did nearly three decades ago, I call for recognition of gentrification's conceptual chaos. For on the ground, particularly as it gains speed and traction in major cities around the globe, gentrification is anything but uniform. In short, our concepts ought to be as complex and versatile as the process itself. Particularly, I argue that our conception of the actors involved, from gentrifiers to those we think of as old-timers and those long-timers we might fail to recognize. So what does this have to do with my opening questions? I think that my chapter on the real people may not be as essential to readers' views of gentrification and social preservation as it is for me because of desire to package gentrification in neat empirical lessons and conceptual categories. After all, I'm not offering a clear set of rules here. Instead, I suggest that gentrification is context-specific and governed more by patterns than laws. I'll close by returning to the patterns I've identified in the selection process. Social preservationists value those whom they believe have a greater claim to authentic community than themselves, as measured by independence, tradition, and relationship to place. These beliefs entangle with preconceived notions about ethnicity, race, class, and sexual identity groups, as well as with local narratives, institutions, and landscape. More often than not, social preservationists in my sites prioritize the preservation of those they regard as independent of institutions, therefore overlooking public housing residents, those living in SROs, and those such as Chinese business owners regarded as too closely connected to formal economic networks. Likewise, their concern for tradition and a close relationship to place means the ignorance of relatively new residents, from Russian immigrants in Dresden to Jamaican seasonal laborers in Provincetown. Acknowledgement of these patterns and of gentrification's variability matters not only for an intellectually honest assessment of gentrification, but also for any effort to intervene therein. Some of the logic about who is an old-timer and who is not directs community efforts, such as the construction of affordable housing that prioritizes families and not, for instance, elderly single LGBT populations or Jamaican laborers, and other practices from murals to museums that inform which groups are best able to resist displacement. I propose that equipped with knowledge of gentrification's variability and of how ordinary actors on the ground engage in the selection of preservable residents, the city planners and officials who facilitated Andersonville and Argyle streetscape planning process, or the selectmen establishing rules about affordable housing access, will be better able to engage in preservation work that targets not a few, but many, to anticipate which groups might be celebrated and which ignored. Thank you for listening.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Japonica Brown Saraceno, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Boston University. Professor Brown Saraceno's lecture was titled The Real People, Race, Class, Ethnicity, and the Politics of Preservation in Gentrifying Neighborhoods. It was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program in the College and Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Professor Linda Haywood from the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.